It's starting to feel like mosquito season out there, and even though there's no evidence the Zika virus is making its way up to our area, local researchers are helping in the search for a vaccine using your computer. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Starting us off this evening, WHYY's Tanya English reports that researchers at Rutgers University want to use a bit of your extra computing power to help find a medicine to treat Zika.
The Zika virus is spread by mosquito bites, and during pregnancy, an infection can result in a serious birth defect. There's no vaccine to prevent or a medicine to cure Zika. But scientists at Rutgers University, New Jersey Medical School are part of a supercomputing project aiming to kickstart the drug discovery process. Professor Joel Frundlich's lab is conducting virtual experiments to pinpoint existing drugs or compounds that could crack Zika.
Sort of a key that could open up a lock. A lock is essentially a vulnerability, a weakness of the virus that we can try to exploit through a drug.
People who want to help by volunteering some of their computing power can download an application to their smartphone or other devices. Rutgers researcher Alex Perryman says it might cost you a bit of extra electricity, but otherwise it's free.
So you can be, you know, surfing online or listening to some music, and the rest of your CPU power can go to help us screen these compounds to see if they might work against Zika.
After narrowing down the number of candidate drugs and some preliminary chemistry work, the next step is to test them against the Zika virus in a so-called wet lab. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
How long will it take a special investigator appointed by Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane to make sense of tens of thousands of emails traded among state judges, prosecutors, and lawyers? Well, apparently a little longer than expected, as WHYY's Dave Davies explains.
You may recall something about Pennsylvania's so-called Porngate scandal, the furor resulting from offensive emails uncovered by Kane, which has ended several careers. In December, long after hundreds of emails had been leaked, Kane said it was time for an exhaustive review of all the messages.
They are not in a private chat room on the internet. They are passed along between judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, law enforcement, and their close friends.
And so Kane appointed former Maryland Attorney General Douglas Gansler, who with his staff from a private law firm would review tens of thousands of emails. He was ready to present a preliminary report today, but Kane's Solicitor General Bruce Castor says the report was not comprehensive, so he canceled the release and sent the investigators back to work. Former federal prosecutor Pete Vira says it's worth waiting for a thorough review because the exchanges of porn suggest a too cozy relationship among legal parties who should be at arm's length.
If a prosecutor is communicating with the judge, sending him very sensitive stuff that you would not send even to your brother-in-law, perhaps, what does this mean about the relationship between the prosecutor and the judge on very sensitive matters of trying the cases?
Castor says he expects additional information and a completed report next week. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Tomorrow marks the 100th anniversary of Justice Louis Brandeis's confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. Cited as one of the most famous and influential justices ever, and his life and legacy are the focus of a new book entitled Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Joining me is author Jeffrey Rosen, also president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and professor at George Washington University Law School. Jeff, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It is great to be back.
You cite in the intro that this certainly isn't the first or only book, but more appropriately, an abridged version of the life and legacy of this esteemed justice. What compelled you to focus on him?
Yale University Press has a great series called Yale Jewish Lives, and they asked me to write about Brandeis, and I jumped at the chance because this great man is my constitutional hero. I think that he was more influential than any other justice in teaching us about privacy and technology in the 20th and 21st century, as well as being the greatest critic of what he called the curse of bigness in business and government since Thomas Jefferson.
Nominated by then President Woodrow Wilson, Brandeis's confirmation process in 1916 was bitterly contested, in part, as you alluded to. I believe he was the first Jewish nominee and first Jew to serve on the court, but perhaps at least as much, if not more so, because he had quite a record coming in.
He did. It was both Brandeis's religion and his crusading opposition to oligarchy and monopoly that caused the opposition. There was some anti-Semitism in the air, But the real source of the opposition was the fact that he had infuriated the most powerful oligarchs in the country, in particular J.P. Morgan, the target of Brandeis's brilliant 1913 book, Other People's Money. That book criticized Morgan and other oligarchs for the reckless risks they took with other people's money, leading people to invest in complicated financial instruments whose value they couldn't possibly understand. Sound familiar? Brandeis would have predicted the crash of 2007. And Brandeis said that this was the result of oligarchic connections between investment banks and commercial banks, and his criticisms led to the Glass-Steagall Act in the New Deal period, which separated commercial from investment banking for several decades until it was dismantled in 1992 and led in part to the crash of 2007. So this amazing prophet, this fiery critic of corporate bigness, was prescient in predicting our crashes and also inspired some of the reforms that helped to avert them.
You say aspects of his focus and his cause resonate with libertarians, other parts of it resonate with progressives, and that also, by contrast, there are parts of his legacy that don't work for those opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yes, it is interesting. Why is it that this great man is not more centrally cited in the election of 2016, where, after all, attacks on the banks are everywhere? I was disappointed to see Senator Sanders attributing his proposal to break up the banks to Theodore Roosevelt and not Brandeis, because actually it was Brandeis who wanted to break up the banks. Roosevelt wanted to regulate them. But the truth is that all of the major candidates today, Sanders, Clinton, and Trump, are more Hamiltonian. Not so surprised. Hamilton's the rap star of the moment. We're all Hamiltonians now. But that big government preference doesn't jibe with progressives who don't like corporate bigness but don't share a similar suspicion of big government. By contrast, the same libertarians who don't like big government and prefer states' rights sometimes lack a similar suspicion of big corporations. So with Brandeis, you get both pieces of the puzzle. Brandeis believed that both big government and big business were threats to individual liberty because only in small-scale businesses and communities could people master the facts that were necessary for self-government. So this is an attempt to really resurrect this very, very inspiring Jeffersonian economic populist tradition. But now that it's really setting off a firestorm in the country and there's this strong current of anger at the economic dislocation wreaked by the big banks and big government, I think resurrecting Brandeis and his criticism of bigness is more relevant than ever.
Louis D. Brandeis, American prophet. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you very much indeed.
Author Jeffrey Rosen is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and professor at George Washington University Law School. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Still ahead this evening, since the 1990s, lifers in Pennsylvania prisons have been unlikely to get their sentences commuted.
Every time you get some legal mail or something, you look, first thing you do is look at the bottom, you know, see if it said denied, 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 because that's, the thing hurts so bad.
But that may be starting to change as more politicians become open to prison reform. Details as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Pennsylvania has roughly 5,300 inmates serving life sentences. That's second only to Florida. That's because in the Commonwealth, as the saying goes, life means life. No possibility of getting out on parole. The only way to get a reduced sentence is to earn what's called a commutation. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that after commutations all but ended in the 1990s, they're now making a small comeback.
In 1976, 29-year-old Thurman Barry faced murder charges for being an accomplice in a robbery during which someone else killed a bystander.
I had an attorney of record, Mr. Harry Siegel. I told him I was not going to plead guilty to something I did not do.
In Pennsylvania, just being involved in a crime that results in a murder can carry a life sentence. Still, Barry's attorney advised him not to plead guilty to a lesser charge, but to accept the murder charges.
He said, here's what the deal is. You plead guilty, you're going to go to prison for, he said, 3.5 to 5 years, and you will be out if you keep your nose clean. I was ignorant of the law big time. I had no idea.
Back then, people serving life could get out early, although it usually took a couple decades. In the 1970s, then-Governor Milton Schaap commuted some 251 life sentences. In the 1980s, the start of the tough-on-crime era, the number of commutations dropped, but lifers could still earn release by working with prison staff and showing good behavior. Then, in 1994, Pennsylvania's Board of Pardons made a fatal mistake in commuting the life sentence of a guy named Reginald McFadden. What McFadden did next not only led to a change in Pennsylvania's constitution, but it also earned him the tawdry true crime show treatment on MSNBC.
You are about to enter the criminal mindscape of serial killer Reginald McFadden.
Were you a monster?
I was the worst of the worst.
When he was just 16, McFadden received a life sentence for murder. 25 years later, the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons ignored some red flags and commuted his sentence. In the process of releasing him, the board also bungled McFadden's paperwork. Instead of going to a halfway house where he'd be supervised, it sent him straight back into society.
He's not in the public very long before he's engaged in kidnapping, sexual assault, and murder.
Reacting to McFadden's slew of new, heinous crimes, Pennsylvania initiated sweeping reforms, including evaluating candidates more thoroughly and requiring a unanimous vote by the board to get a commutation. That makes the road to release a lot steeper. Former Governor Tom Corbett granted zero commutations during his 4 years in office. Now that is starting to change. A tough-on-crime attitude is being replaced by one vowing to be smart on crime.
It's not really smart to keep these people in prison forever.
That's Lieutenant Governor Mike Stack, who chairs the Board of Pardons under Governor Wolf.
You know, if they have demonstrated that they can make a positive impact, it's stupid for taxpayers to continue to spend exorbitant amounts of money.
For example, elderly prisoners who are unlikely to reoffend place an enormous financial burden on the state, says Stack. To move things along, his office has hired more staff and digitized processes that used to take place on pen and paper. Commutations don't exactly speed through the Board of Pardons now, but at least in the case of Thurman Berry, worthy applicants can get a hearing. During his 39 years in prison, he applied for commutations before.
Yes, but I filed for five times. Five times I was denied. Every time you get some legal mail or something, you look, first thing you do is look at the bottom, you know, see if it said denied, 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 because that thing hurts so bad.
Last year, Berry got help. An advocate in the prison gave his name to a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Her students researched arguments to support his sixth application. This time, he made it through interviews with prison staff and psychologists all the way to the Board of Pardons. Sitting in a meeting room in prison, he made his case to the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, and the rest of the board.
Initially, they were looking at me like I was a pariah. Like I was, you know, a menace to society or something.
Berry demonstrates the looks he got, leaning forward in his chair, his eyes wide. He'd written up his testimony and just tried to stick to it.
But by the time I was about three quarters done through that first page, I'm no longer being stared at. I'm being, you know, listened to.
Berry, now 68, became one of the first two people to get the board's approval for commutation in 6 years. He knows now he has to be the poster child for good behavior on the outside because his commutation has given a lot of people serving life sentences hope.
A lot of them gave up. They said, the hell with it, they just gave up. They wouldn't apply, period. But after my success, that lit a fire under so many people. You could see the joy going, I mean, you could feel it.
Lieutenant Governor Mike Stack says that awareness has translated into more applications and more work for the Board of Pardons. There are currently 54 applications for commutation up for review. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Campaigning in California yesterday in advance of that state's primary 1 week from tomorrow, Bernie Sanders reaffirmed that he's not planning to concede to rival Hillary Clinton until the Democratic Party's convention in July. He'll be on hand in Philadelphia, as will Aaron Biggs, a Sanders delegate from Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Aaron, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I understand you've had politics in your blood for a long time. In college, you were working with the Ted Kennedy campaign.
Yeah, I interned for his office on the Capitol.
This must be a dream come true for you to attend the Democratic National Convention.
It is. It's very exciting, and I'm so honored and grateful to be a part of it.
Well, welcome to Philadelphia. If you haven't been here before, it'll be a little warmer than what you might be used to in Steamboat Springs, even in July.
Yes, that is absolutely true.
So what are the logistics of coming east? Who's paying for it, for example?
It is all on the delegates. So I am fundraising like a madwoman, trying to raise money for the hotel, food, airfare, everything.
Do you have a budget? Do you have a sense of what it's going to cost overall?
Well, the Democratic Party of Colorado gave us a guideline of around $5,000 to $6,200. So I am shooting for somewhere in that area. And I have a fundraising site online, and I've been lucky to have the support of the Rout County Democrats. So we've been doing some fundraising activities as well.
Does that allotment account for a carve-out for cheesesteaks and tasty cakes?
Yes, that is very important. That is the part my husband is looking forward to the most.
Now, let's stay optimistic. Having said that, what happens if you get close but don't meet the goal?
You know, I don't want to even think about that, to be honest. I have had so much support, and I have been so humbled by the amazing people that have come out and supported me that I believe we're going to make it. We have just under 2 months right now, and we're about 38% of our goal, so I feel like we can do this.
That's the same kind of energy as your cohort of Bernie Sanders fans. They still feel he can make it.
Yeah, absolutely, and so do I. You know, he doesn't have the big money backing him, and neither do I. The exciting thing about his campaign is that it's all grassroots, and that's kind of my fundraising as well. It's all grassroots, and together I think we're going to do this. You know, his slogan is not me, us, and I have really taken that to heart. It's not about me. It's about us. It's about the movement.
Hey, Aaron, any of your cohort of delegates from your county doing the same thing to raise money, or are there different ways to go at it?
Yes, pretty much everyone from the Colorado delegation is all raising money in as many ways as we can think of. We all have crowdfunding campaigns online. We're doing silent auctions. One of our delegates actually shaved his beard to raise money. So any way we can do it.
I want to take you back to 2008. Hillary was running against Barack Obama, and a super PAC that supported her was called PUMA. And you might recall they were folks who said at the time they weren't going to back Obama, contending that they wanted a nominee selected by not the leadership, but rather the voters. There's a similarity this time around. Can you personally say that you would ultimately support Hillary Clinton if she indeed becomes the nominee of the Democratic Party?
You know, that is a question that keeps me up at night. I'll be honest with you. A lot of the people that have voted for me and supported me are leaning that direction. I certainly don't want to see Donald Trump as our president. I think that would be a disaster, not only for this country, but for the world. So if that's what it comes down to, then I think that I have no choice but to vote for Hillary and support her. But at this point, I think it's too early to say. I think Bernie is doing great. We have the primary coming up in California, and his campaign is so energized. And I really want to focus on that right now before even thinking about the what if.
Aaron, we're looking forward to seeing you and all in Philadelphia. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, that's Aaron Biggs, a Sanders delegate from Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Finally this evening, an honorary U.S. Marshal was installed in an unusual ceremony in the James Byrne Courthouse in Philadelphia today.
I will obey my parents, my teachers, always look out for my sister. Say, I will.
I will.
Very good. You are now United States Marshal.
5-year-old Dominic Mascantonio received the honor for supporting his baby sister, who suffers from a rare form of brain cancer. When the Pope visited Philadelphia last September, the FBI worked with the Secret Service to get Gianna and her family close to the pontiff. When the Pope mobile passed, Pope Francis bent down and kissed Gianna. 2 months later, her condition had improved dramatically. FBI Special Agent in Charge William Sweeney called it the miracle of Market Street, though an actual miracle can only be declared by a committee at the Vatican. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. The rain that fell this past weekend was a headache for many, and it's an everyday concern for the Philadelphia Water Department as they try to better manage the city's stormwater runoff. Tomorrow evening, we'll hear about a program that lets residents join that effort. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.